Welcome to the Film Sommelier Podcast with Caleb Brown and his brother Ben Brown. That's the name of the podcast. His brother Ben Brown is not present. So, Caleb, we're here in the writer's room trying to crunch through this final draft is the name of the document, which is a name that I like. And that means that we're not going to overhaul it. We've gone through a lot of iterations, and the most recent draft picks up on some of the ideas from the last podcast that we did, talking about the zeitgeist, which we kind of honed in on this term, frustrated masculinity, and you almost completely rewrote the outline, keeping some of the sections from the beginning, but trying to integrate these themes of finding the fantastic in the mundane in the movie The Incredibles, but also looking for how Bob Parr, as the what you call patient character, is almost operated on by the agent in order to become something different than what he is at the beginning. So at the beginning, at the beginning we see him doing what he loves. He's fighting crime. He's engaged in his work. And then in the first 10 minutes we see him already kind of defeated by this world that has rejected the role of superheroes, and in particular has rejected this sort of more masculine archetype of the strong superhero. And so over the course of the film, he needs to learn how to embrace, what would you say, a softer, gentler side, or what makes him more incredible at the end of the film than at the beginning of the film?
Well, it might help to give some background on the creator. Brad Bird had thought he hadn't really put a lot of himself in this movie, but in retrospect, he sees that he had. So Brad Bird was in a situation where he just made his first movie, and he was having a lot of meetings in town, and nothing was moving forward, and he had a young family, and he wasn't able to provide for them unless he got something going. And so it was like he was facing a situation where he wasn't able to do the work that he loves, which is direct animated movies, and there was this pull. Family was important to him. And it was kind of like, you know, what are my choices here? Like so imagine him coming home from a bad pitch meeting, and he's like smoldering, he's not really engaged with his wife or his kids. So here he is in this horrible situation where he's pining for a particular kind of work, and since he isn't able to do it, he's disengaged at work and disengaged at home. So like, where's the joy in that? It's all gone. So I think what the movie comes to by the end is like, you know, it sucks, Bob, that you're not able to do the work that you want to do right now, but you can still find some joy right now. You're in front of a lovely family that matters, and you know, your job's frustrating, sure, but like, you do that job for them anyway. So try and incorporate your love for family into love for job. And yeah. Power your time at the job with your the fact that you're a family man, and that's what is in front of you right now.
Okay, so in The Incredibles 2, we see this sort of taken to the next level where not only does he have to work a mundane office job, he's actually, looks like Helen is tapped to be the lead superhero in this superhero revival that's going on. They're getting a super slick PR makeover. But Helen is nominated as the face of the new superhero movement, while Bob is relegated to raising the kids. And this isn't even working outside of the house. This is literally, you know, taking the traditional role of the wife. So at the end of the first Incredibles, it's not like we see Bob going back to some sort of regular work. We might hope, I think, as a viewer, that he's going to find something that he'll be able to do that will still be using his superpowers outside of raising a family. No?
I'm so curious and in suspense about how they handle the ending of this movie. I think it's telling that, like, yeah, you described it as Bob being relegated,
yeah.
Which, you know, that, you know, I watch English Premier League football, and what happens you know, when a team gets relegated, is they get moved from the upper division to the lower division. Mm. And I think that is what men feel about, you know, being a, you know, what the 60s they call a house husband or a stay-at-home dad. It feels like relegation. And that's why the fact that we still see that as relegation is what powers the sense that this is a noteworthy and extraordinary premise for a film. Hmm. If we were in Sweden, I guess, and it was just commonplace for a man to stay home and watch the kids. I'm not even sure if that's the case in Sweden or not. But like, if you imagine some world where there is no difference between the genders, then this wouldn't be a movie premise. But it is for us, which says something. Says something either, you know, if we're on the left, it's about our internalized hegemony, or if we're on the right, it's like, it's just natural law, baby. But that accounts for what makes it interesting. So it seems as if there's two options. Bob goes through the trial of enduring relegation, so to speak, and he emerges content and stays there. Or it could be that he goes through this trial of relegation and he gets promoted again. Do you see any other options? I'd be interested if there are.
I think at the end of The Incredibles 1, you see sort of the superhero family where everyone has moved out.
And that feels good. It feels good for the family to be, you know, a super family now. Mm-hmm. And they're together in that.
Right.
And I wonder. So there are some indications that, that this isn't face value, a movie about, you know, it may not, in fact, be a movie celebrating the destruction of gender norms, like to use a value, non-neutral term. But the fact that Bob Odenkirk plays the billionaire who's trying to elevate Helen, like even just in his character design, we distrust the man. Mm-hmm. And so apparently this opportunity for Helen is not 100% positive, we can expect, I think. So it won't be without hiccups or admixture of challenges.
Life is about more than being incredible. Mm. This is true. So Brad Bird has some ambitions to be an incredible director, which he is. Mm. And the world is a better place for it. We assume, feels more fulfilled than if he were still, you know, banging his head against the wall, pitching ideas and getting them rejected. So if life is about more than being incredible, is there still some sort of value in, or what is it that Bob is learning in the first Incredibles about the mundane that allows him to feel more satisfied with a mundane life? Mm.
Yeah, what he encounters the consequences of his vice, which would be vanity, and you can even see some echoes in like the first sequence of the movie. Mm-hmm. Where he's overlooking small things that end up becoming really big things. So, one, not handling this psycho fan with a little more grace. Which comes back to haunt him, not just later in the film, but also, you know, Buddy and his interference in the opening sequence is what causes the train to blow up, and like for Bob have to throw himself at the train and cause the whiplashes and all this stuff. So, yeah, there's other things. Bob was kind of like, he has a hammer, he sees nails all around him, and he's kind of like swatting at stuff. You know, I think you pointed out that, like, you know, that money that Bon Voyage stole, it's probably insured. Not worth, you know, destroying buildings and city infrastructure over it. Probably cost way more for the city to cover Bob Parr's attempt at stopping the bank robbery than what Bon Voyage would have taken off with. So, like, you know, was he really... Yeah, was his strength really called for in that situation?
Yeah.
Not to that degree. Mm-hmm. similarly, like with the guy committing suicide and he saves him. And now I think everybody in the audience is like totally flabbergasted and offended by the fact that someone whose life had been saved would then sue the superhero who saved him. It's not without precedent legally, I'm guessing. Well, the superhero thing is, but so like these are instances in which he exerted his strength and when they weren't necessarily called for. And yeah, so that's Bob even in his young days not really paying attention to the details, overlooking the small things that could tell him part of a larger story.
Yeah.
And I think he, Helen in contrast is very good at that throughout the film. And he in the end comes to see that like his family, look, yeah, so what? There's these missing opportunities to make a difference in the city, stopping this fire or this that robbery. But there's also a family right in front of him that isn't going to be around forever.
Yeah.
And so Helen is right. He's missing this. He can miss this if he's still looking elsewhere to assuage his like throbbing manhood, I guess. I don't want to say, but yeah, so Bob, he learns through what he believes was a loss of his family, he learns the true value of his family to his person, that superhero work is not more important to him than the health and well-being of those he loves. And I think Helen gets to see that at the end, right before the fight with the robot, and that's kind of like the B plot climax of the movie, when Helen recognizes that Bob is doesn't love his work more than family.
Yeah.
And the denouement is beautiful in that Bob, having previously made fun of the fact that we hand out graduation certificates from people moving to fourth grade or the fifth grade, and like presumably like participation trophies and this whole like culture of mediocrity, like he's like makes a very compelling speech against that, and then by the end he's celebrating mediocrity when his son intentionally crosses the finish line in second place.
Yeah.
And what's changed is he sees the strength and competence involved in Dash restraining his natural abilities to abide within the constraints that they're currently living under, like what's called for. There was no reason for Dash to blow everybody away. There was no benefits to be gained except like a temporary flash of like, oh my goodness, from the audience, and then probably there's like legal backlash and all these people's brains got to be erased and the family's relocated again. There's just no, it's not worth it. So in some sense the movie comes to a kind of a sort of accepting compromise with the world that doesn't tolerate them being super. But at the same time, they've come to, Bob, I guess in particular, has grown in understanding that there are only particular contexts where it pays to be super. You know, he could wear himself out being super all day. And yet, like, it would all be all smoke and vanity if he weren't just responding to the thing that he needed to. And so one of those things is raising his family. So, and he wasn't responding to that call. Now he is. He's fully invested. He's into it. And he's appreciating the strength that it takes to be humble and to accept the opportunities that he's given instead of the ones that he wants.
Yeah. We've talked about how it seems like men are no longer needed to fulfill the same functions that they did in earlier times, whether that's sort of protecting society or, I think, going even further back, just taming nature and bringing it under under his domain. That's something where, you know, we have maybe even in some ways tamed nature too much, or you know, the last thing that needs to be tamed, the last thing that man needs to tame in a way is himself.
Yeah, well put.
And restraint being the hardest thing of all, requiring the most strength. I think that's a really powerful idea, that, you know, sort of supernatural restraint requires supernatural strength.
Mm.
And here in The Incredibles, we have, you know, the supernatural strength. There's one kind of supernatural strength, which is super speed or elastic capabilities or just being super strong. But then there's this other meaning of supernatural, which is just, you know, not entirely of human origin.
Mm.
Mm. And I think that's an interesting thing to explore. Maybe not necessarily in this video, but it's something that I think has to be asked for and then voluntarily received and kind of continually, you know, rinse, wash, repeat that over and over again. It's not a one-time battle, but I would imagine that something like parenting or raising a family involves a lot of those day-to-day tests, more so than if you don't have a family or if you don't have kids, because, you know, the best parenting is firm but gentle. So it's you know, you can't just lash out at your kids. That doesn't solve the problem. And in the same way, you know, with the remaining societal problems, it's not really a matter of taming them maybe in the same way that we tamed nature in earlier eras. I don't know. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no. Oswald Chambers, he's a Protestant theologian who wrote that it takes all of the power of God in a man for him to do a mundane thing well. So that's pretty on point for the Incredibles movie.
Oswald Chambers.
I got to look up that quote, but that's pretty much what he says. And it was always a puzzle to me. It was like, wow, that sounds deep. All the power of God, like for a man to do something mundane. I think this movie puts flesh on those bones. It's just, and I'll do another quote just in terms of like, we've mastered the oceans and space travel, but have we mastered our...
Have we mastered those things?
We've mastered our very souls. Let's just say we've made less progress in the mastering of human nature than nature proper. And I love Francis Bacon's quote that nature, in order to be commanded, must first be obeyed. And that was a credo of, you know, Enlightenment era physical description of physical phenomenon. We have to understand nature on its terms. And this is kind of, in some sense, the reason for the departure from an Aristotelian physics, which was a lot of like human categories trying to shove natural phenomenon into them, and instead just be docile in front of nature and try and use observation and mathematics to describe what we're actually seeing as opposed to what we think should be there. And I think you're right. Like, that credo, nature to be commanded must first be obeyed. And we've been following that for like half a millennium, and it's made a tremendous amount of progress. I'll throw out there, like, human nature to be commanded must also be obeyed.
Yeah.
And I think there are elements of human nature that people on both sides of this I had a better term for this, not gender roles, gender norms debate. Like, who are probably ignoring different facets of human nature. And trying to shove the phenomenon into their own categories that they came to the store with. And I think we should be docile in front of human nature. And if it is a case that, like, there's, you know, a man can't help but feel relegated if he's asked to take care of the kids exclusively and have no role outside of the house, you know, maybe we need to obey that. It may also be true that men, through their fragile vanity, seek to maintain some sense of self-worth by removing themselves from their family life, or even worse, like needing their wife or to be like subservient. Surely that exists as well. So Yeah.
But is there something to the idea of men being better positioned? Maybe this is part of human nature. Men being the risk takers, the ones who go out and... it was thought until recently that male lions didn't actually do any of the hunting.
Huh.
That they just laid around all day while the women went out hunting. But it turned out that the men actually go out at night. And they just, until they had the night vision cameras, they didn't know this.
Interesting.
So there's sort of, I think one of the patterns that you see in nature is men being able to go out and take risks on behalf of the collective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so that is not, it's not abandoning, it's just, it's going out in order to return. It's the exodus before the
reditus. Yeah. Nice. At the same time, this idea of like, yeah, I have a lot of like attraction and affinity to this exodus reditus movement of masculinity, if you will. Leave the hearth or leave the village in order to return with something to benefit everybody there. I want to throw out there also this idea that, like, you know, before the 19th century, we didn't leave our homes to go to work. We stayed here. We stayed within, you know, maybe not in the house, certainly not in the house, but like, we, you know, we'd go like a few acres maybe. So maybe that's enough to satisfy the Exodus Reditus pattern that feels natural.
Mm-hmm.
But another argument would be like that this rhythm of leaving the home and returning to it for the sake of labor is something that's so familiar to us, it doesn't look like this contingent thing about the result of the Industrial Revolution. But I can get behind, you know, even when the farming days, the man's role was probably outside the house.
Mm.
I think that's cross-cultural.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if you look at the risk-taking roles that were more specialized in any previous era, those almost all probably belonged to men, mm-hmm. whether it was...
Yeah. You know.
So anyway, getting back to our final draft, because we think we're pretty close to launching a website and some things that will attract people to all these insights that take time to unpack for any particular story. And this is just sort of the demo showing how we have taken apart The Incredibles so that we can understand how a story functions better. You conclude the script. You say, I'm just going to read the last 8 lines or short lines. You say, when all's resolved, we find Bob wholeheartedly cheering for Dash's mediocre finish. Bob recognizes the superior strength involved in restraint. He's become more than just incredible. The premise of Incredibles 2 may be a natural extension of Bob's character arc in the first movie. Will the new movie double down on Bob's learning the same lesson, or will there be some contrast? I'll be there on opening day to find out. And we've talked about just how in the second one, it may not be that the setup for the second movie might not lead us necessarily to the idea that Bob needs to accept his new fate as stay-at-home dad, but that he might learn something in the process that allows him to be a more effective sort of servant leader, someone who humbles himself in order that he can be elevated to his right to a place that's in line with his true talents or something like that.
It also may be the case that, like, you know, you talk about this risk taking role. I think in some ways, like, I sense a craving that Bob, by virtue of staying home, would serendipitously or by some villain's design be in a situation to take the risk to save and preserve his family by being home. Would be a satisfying direction for the story to go.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I may have interrupted you.
No, that's an interesting prognostication, and I was sort of hoping for an interruption there. And then one other section that I want to read just to see if we can kind of tinker with it or if we like this the way that it is. You write that Helen isn't afraid, but has a different relationship with the mundane. She's not afraid of the mundane, but she has a different relationship with it. Instead of seeing it as the enemy of her specialness, she embraces it. She can find purpose in whatever's in front of her. And she's upset Bob can't discover the same truth. Bob's attitude at the beginning of the story is that the mundane is the enemy of the incredible. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, you know, Bob, like a lot of men, you know, who may feel less fulfilled in their line of work. Yeah, I can see him finding a lot of we do see him seeking some sort of stimulation or solace through reading the important news events of the day so that he can brush against something bigger. We also have some illustrations of him watching sports. I think a lot of men lean on spectator sports to kind of like get that sense of, you know, at least watching men in high challenge, high, you know, it's hard to call them high stakes because there's a lot of honor at stake, I guess. But there's not like, you know, health and wealth of the country stakes.
There's money.
There is money. Yeah, yeah. But high challenge is the thing. I mean, maybe it's best to couch it in terms of like the psychology of peak performance. You know, the book Flow by Mikhail Csikszentmihalyi. And if, yeah. And yeah, I think it's rare for a man to find flow in his work. Or maybe it's just unfortunate if a man doesn't find flow in his work.
Yeah.
And is there, therefore, diverted to things like, yeah, being a news junkie or a sports fanatic or a video game addict to fill that void of flow. These aren't the preoccupations of a lazy man. They're preoccupations of the man hungry for a challenge and isn't getting one. And so the problem, though, is that Bob and I think other men's reliance upon these vain challenges is that it really just makes you weaker.
Yeah.
In terms of engaging with the mundane. It's just not fast enough. It's just not challenging enough.
Yeah.
And so, but with the right mindset, you know, if you start to think like a Zen master or like a Catholic saint, a monk, like you can find flow brushing your teeth.
Yeah.
And wouldn't you rather have that frame of mind?
Yeah.
Where it's like, I don't experience this frame of mind very often, but I remember it was in one of my early jobs. I was a waiter at a Chili's in Midland, Texas, and I just finished a long shift, made like $80, I'm sure, and here I am cleaning up my booths, pulling out the chairs and sweeping up everybody else's food that's falling out of their mouths, and I'm just kind of like inwardly resistant to this like horribly mundane, in some sense humiliating task. Just scooping food and dirt into a pan, and I had this kind of like moment of grace where it was like, wait a minute, like if you think about like all the physics at work here, it's like the coefficient of friction between the brush of the broom and the floor and the speed at which the particles are hitting the pan, and like the fact that I'm in this room in which food from across the globe is getting shipped to, and the fact that a restaurant and a brand with global, with like an internet, like a national footprint that advertises at Super Bowl is just like, oh my goodness, this is it's an amazing thing happening right now.
Yeah.
If that's the kind of frame of mind that you can keep, you know, from the time you wake up to the time you go to bed, like that's probably Zen. That's probably in way more valuable than being able. Because that's what allows you to be tuned in to the moment that calls for your utter sacrifice and participation.
Yeah.
It may be worth bringing in Kung Fu Panda, if you saw that movie.
I didn't. I've heard a little bit about it, though.
Yeah, this is a really great triptych of scenes. Probably not triptych, just diptych. So the panda's reluctant sensei, this kind of red panda, he walks in to meet the master of karate, who's this old turtle. And this turtle is one by one blowing out every candle. And he can see there's like 300 of them.
Mm-hmm.
And he's not going to get to talk to this master until all the candles are out. And yeah. So he gets frustrated and impatient. And so he uses his kung fu to like disturb the air enough to wipe out, to extinguish all the candles at once.
Yeah.
And we're kind of like, oh, good. We didn't want to watch that either.
Right, yeah.
But when you come to it, like Master Oogway, you end up seeing that kind of mindfulness as an incredible strength that he's cultivated over, you know, a lifetime.
Yeah.
And he's the one who responds at the right moment with the right kung fu expertise to disable the bad guy.
Yeah.
In the backstory.
Yeah.
So there's a, yeah, those two movies kind of go together in my mind, I suppose.
Yeah. That reminds me of a idea that I had yesterday. It was to not exercise for more time in the day than I pray. Not necessarily on any given day, but you know, in any given week, if I'm exercising more than I'm praying, that means that my priorities might be out of line.
Mm.
And I think, and that doesn't include, you know, all movement that conceivably has some side benefits. And similarly, you know, I think the idea of prayer without ceasing,
mm-hmm.
that you can make any activity into a prayer.
Yeah.
There's a good joke about some guy who goes to a priest and asks if he can smoke while he's praying. And the priest says no. And he says, well, can I pray while I'm smoking? And he says, sure, that's fine. So, you know, it's just sort of
interesting.
Change of perspective, but the idea of it being a Zen like activity, I think you could also substitute the phrase the state of grace,
mm-hmm.
Or you know, being in that state where you know everything you do feels right. I've also heard something. I think this is maybe from the Buddhist tradition, but you could just as easily frame it another way. It's like when you're on the right path, there is no choice. Like there's only, if you're doing God's will, if you set your mind to do God's will, then there's no choice. I don't know how that really.
I mean, it's kind of like, yeah, instead of thinking of freedom as a bunch of options,
mm-hmm.
like freedom. The freedom that comes from the state of grace is like the freedom to go forward.
Mm-hmm.
That's the one that matters anyway.
Yeah.
As opposed to being hung up or distracted.
Yeah. So if I were to tweak this outline, I think that I would make it a little bit more of a rallying. Well, I don't know. This is hard to say. I'd like to get your perspective on this. I was going to say more of a rallying call for young men to wake up from the all of the soul-sucking unrealities that dominate our lives with computers and distractions and video games, and to find some way of being incredible that is compatible with their with where they stand, that maybe aims at where they want to be but starts from where they are. And I don't know. Yeah, I think that could be kind of incorporated just into the zeitgeist, and I don't think that it's betraying the truth or any sort of the nature of things to say that men can learn something from women who seem to at least in a certain environment be better at kind of taming themselves, and that maybe this is where there's some, like, rather than invert gender norms, but trying to subvert traditional masculinity in the sense that, like, primal masculinity is untamed masculinity, but tamed masculinity involves some sort of, you know, bringing your own will and understanding under the I just lost my train of thought, but bringing it under the domain of bringing it under
of reality and love.
Sure.
Yeah. I think that's great. Distinction between primal masculinity, which like these sort of, you know, these awkward far right people are like seem to be holding up as like, what a tragedy that we're losing this, and like Nietzsche too, perhaps the original Twitter troll.
Yeah,
I think we could use a lot more celebration of tamed masculinity. You know, the word gentleman is ruined. Because gentle doesn't sound like something a man should want to be. But in reality, like, yeah, gentleness requires strength. Gentleness is a virtue that restrains anger.
Yeah.
That restrains resentment.
Mm-hmm.
That allows you to be rational as opposed to rash.
Yeah.
And, you know, I feel very sorry for the men who don't have the grace of a wife to be a companion, sometimes not a companion, it's a grace that sometimes you don't want of someone who's there to kind of like, you're living in a fantasy world right now, like this is the real world. And I think I think it's easier for men to not behold reality because of well, that's not true. I think
there's a push pull sort of. There's like the, I think that, you know, if the man can extend in one direction and then be sort of pruned back a little bit and then extend, you know, maybe that's an important dynamic.
Yeah, maybe I'll put it like this, like the curse or like a diseased masculinity would be a man off in outer space, aimlessly floating in the void, unmoored, like unattached to anything, would be masculinity to the non-virtuous extreme, a free radical, femininity to it at its diseased would just be completely self-absorbed and isolated in that way. I kind of like seeing the world just in terms of like, a very limited sphere of convenience and justice. The two work together to provide some balance. It's almost like it was made that way.
Yeah. Well, we're coming up on the 40-minute mark, which is about as long as my attention span lasts in these days of media distractions. So we will try to turn our attention now to the next step of this final draft, the final, final draft.
Thanks for listening to the Film Sommelier Podcast. For more insights into your favorite films, go to thestorylocker.com.